by the legal proceedings against Ward and Fontenot. There was no evidence other than the confessions, and, as shocking as they were so full of contradictions that they could not be believed. Nonetheless, Mayer strove to present a balanced picture of the crime and the trial. His book, The Dreams of Ada, was published by Viking in April 1987 and was greatly anticipated by the town. The reaction was swift but predictable. Some people discounted the book because of the author's friendliness with the Ward family. Others were convinced the boys were guilty because they confessed, and nothing could ever change their opinions. There was also a widespread belief that the police and the prosecutors had botched the case, sent the wrong men to prison, and left the real killers out there. Stung by the criticism, it's rare for a small-town prosecutor to have a book written about one of his cases, and a very unflattering one at that, Bill Peterson roared into action in the Debbie Carter matter. He had something to prove. The investigation was stale. The poor girl had been dead for more than 4 years, but it was time to nail someone. Peterson and the police had believed for years that the killer was Ron Williamson. Perhaps Dennis Fritz was involved, maybe not, but they knew Williamson was in Carter's apartment that night. They had no evidence, just gut feelings. Ron was out of prison and back in Ada. When his mother died in August 1985, he was in jail awaiting a competency hearing and staring at 2 more years in prison. Annette and Renee reluctantly sold the small house where they had grown up. When Ron was paroled from prison in October 1986, he had no place to live. He moved in with Annette and her husband and son, and for a few days tried hard to fit in. But his old habits returned. The late-night meals he prepared with great noise, the all-night television routine at full volume, the smoking and drinking, and the day-long naps on the sofa. After a month or so, with nerves frayed and her family on edge, Annette had to ask him to leave. The 2 years in prison had done nothing to improve his mental health. He had moved in and out of various state hospitals, with different doctors trying different combinations of drugs. Often, there were no medications at all. He would survive for a while in the general prison population, then someone would notice his bizarre behavior, and off he'd go to another mental unit. Upon his release, the Department of Corrections made an appointment for Ron to see a social worker at Mental Health Services in Ada. On October 15th, he met Norma Walker, who noted that he was taking lithium, Navane, and Artane. She found him to be pleasant, controlled, and a little strange, sometimes staring without saying anything for as long as a minute at a time. He planned to go to a Bible college and maybe become a minister. Or he might start his own construction company. Big plans, a bit grandiose, thought Walker. 2 weeks later, still medicated, he kept his appointment and appeared to be doing fine. He skipped the next two, and when he showed up on December 9th, he demanded to see Dr. Marie Snow. He had stopped taking his meds because he'd met a girl who didn't believe in them. Dr. Snow tried to convince him to start taking his pills, but he said that God had told him to give up the booze and all drugs. He missed appointments on December 18th and January 14th. On February 16th, Annette called Norma Walker and said his behavior could not be controlled. She described him as psychotic and said he had mentioned killing himself with a handgun. The next day, he came in, very nervous but somewhat reasonable. He demanded a change in medication. 3 days later, Walker received a call from McCall's Chapel. Ron was making a scene, yelling and demanding a job. She advised them to treat him with caution and call the police if necessary. That afternoon, Annette and her husband brought him in to meet with Walker. They were distraught and desperate for help. Walker observed Ron to be unmedicated, confused, disoriented, delusional, detached from reality, and completely unable to take care of his own food and shelter. She doubted he could survive on his own even with proper medication. The solution was long-term institutionalization for his diminished mental capacities and unmanageable behavior. The three left with no plan and no meds. Ron drifted around Ada and eventually disappeared. Gary Simmons was at his home in Chickasha one night, chatting with two friends, when the doorbell rang. He answered it, and his brother-in-law rushed in and collapsed on the living room floor.
"I need help," Ron said over and over. "I'm crazy, and I need help."
Unshaven, filthy, his hair thick and matted, he was disoriented and not sure where he was.
"I can't take it anymore," he said.
Gary's guests did not know Ron and were shocked by his appearance and desperation. One left, and the other hung around. Ron became quiet, then lethargic. Gary promised Ron he would find help in some way, and they eventually got him in a car. The first stop was the nearest hospital, where they were referred to the local mental health center. From there, they were sent to Central State Hospital in Norman. As they were driving, Ron became almost catatonic. He did manage to say that he was starving. Gary knew a ribs place famous for its large servings, but when they stopped in the parking lot, Ron asked,
"Where are we?"
"We're getting something to eat," Gary replied. Ron swore he wasn't hungry, so they drove away, headed for Norman.
"Why did we stop back there?"
Ron asked. "Because you said you were hungry."
"I did not."
Ron was irritated by Gary's actions. A few miles closer to Norman, Ron again said he was very hungry. Gary saw a McDonald's and stopped.
"What are we doing here?" Ron asked.
"We're getting something to eat," Gary replied.
"Why?"
"Because you said you were hungry."
"I'm not hungry. Could we just please hurry on to the hospital?"
They left McDonald's and finally arrived in Norman, at which time Ron announced he was hungry. Gary patiently found another McDonald's, and Ron, not surprisingly, asked why they were stopping. The last stop before the hospital was for gas at a Vickers station on Main Street. Gary returned to the car with two large candy bars, which Ron grabbed and devoured in seconds. Gary and his friend were startled at how quickly he consumed them. At Central State, Ron was drifting in and out of whatever stupor he was in. The first doctor became frustrated when he wouldn't cooperate, and as soon as he left the room, Gary chastised his brother-in-law. Ron responded by standing and facing a blank wall, flexing his arms into a goofy bodybuilder pose, and becoming rigid for several long minutes. Gary tried to speak to him, but he was gone. 10 minutes passed, and Ron didn't flinch. He stared at the ceiling without making a sound or moving a muscle. 20 minutes passed, and Gary was ready to bolt. After 30 very long minutes, Ron snapped out of it, but still would not speak to Gary. Fortunately, the staff soon arrived and took Ron to his room. He told a doctor,
"I just wanted to come here because I needed a place to go to at this time."
He was given lithium for depression and Novane, an antipsychotic drug used to treat schizophrenia. Once he was stabilized, he checked himself out against the advice of his doctors and within a few days was back in Ada. Gary's next road trip with his brother-in-law was to Dallas to a Christian mission program for ex-cons and addicts. Gary's pastor had met Ron and wanted to help. Quietly, the pastor confided to Gary, "Ron's lights are on, but no one's home." They checked into the facility in Dallas. When Ron was situated, Gary said goodbye. In doing so, he slipped Ron $50 in cash, a violation of the rules, though neither knew it. Gary returned to Oklahoma, and so did Ron. Within hours of checking in, he had used the cash to purchase a bus ticket back to Ada and arrived not long after Gary. His next admission to Central State was not voluntary. On March 21st, 9 days after being discharged, Ron attempted suicide by swallowing 20 Novane pills. His reason, given to a nurse, was that he was depressed because he could not find a job. He was stabilized and placed on proper medication, which he stopped taking after the third day. His doctors concluded that he was a danger to himself and others and recommended a 28-day treatment at Central State. On March 24th, he was discharged. Back in Ada, Ron found a room behind a small house on 12th Street, on the west side of town. He had no kitchen and no plumbing. To shower, when he bathed, he used a water hose behind the house. Annette took him food and tried to care for him. During one visit, she noticed his wrists were bleeding. He'd cut them with a razor, he said, so that he could suffer like all the others who'd suffered so much because of him. He wanted to die and be with his parents, the two people he'd hurt so much. She begged him to go see a doctor, but he refused. He also refused to get help at the mental services office, where he'd been so many times. He was completely off his medications. The old man who owned the house was kind to Ron. Rent was cheap, often free. In the garage, there was an ancient lawnmower with one wheel missing. Ron pushed it up and down the streets of Ada, mowing lawns for $5 and giving the money to his landlord. On April 4th, the Ada police received a call from a residence on the west block of 10th Street. The homeowner informed the patrolman that he had to leave town, and he feared for the safety of his family because Ron Williamson had been roaming through the neighborhood at all hours of the night. Evidently, the homeowner knew Ron and was watching carefully. He told the cop that Ron had made 4 trips to the Circle K convenience store and 2 or 3 to Love's convenience store, all in one night. The policeman was sympathetic. Everyone knew Ron was acting weird. But there was no law against walking the streets after midnight. He promised to patrol the area. On April 10th, at 3 in the morning, the police received a call from a clerk at the Circle K. Ron Williamson had been in several times, acting really strange. While Officer Jeff Smith was making his report, the suspect showed up again. Smith asked Ronnie to leave, which he did. An hour later, Ron walked to the jail and rang the buzzer and announced that he wanted to confess several crimes that he had committed in his past. He was given a form for a voluntary statement and began writing. He admitted to stealing a purse 4 years earlier at the coach light, stealing a gun from a home, touching 2 girls on their private parts, and hitting and almost raping a girl up at Asher. But he abandoned his confession and left the jail. Officer Rick Carson followed and caught up with him a few blocks away. Ron tried to explain what he was doing at that hour, but was very confused. He finally said he was out looking for mowing jobs. Carson suggested that Ron go home, and that perhaps the mowing jobs might be easier to find during daylight hours. On April 13th, Ron went to the mental health clinic and frightened the workers. One of them described him as drooling. He demanded to see Dr. Snow and started down a hallway to her office. When told she wasn't in, he left without incident. 3 days later, The Dreams of Ada was published. As much as the police wanted to pin the Carter murder on Ron Williamson, they simply lacked sufficient proof. By the late spring of 1987, they had little more evidence than they'd had in the summer of 1983. The hair analysis from the OSBI had finally been completed, 2 years after the murder. Some of the samples taken from Ron and Dennis were microscopically consistent with some of the hairs found at the murder scene, but hair comparisons were wildly unreliable. The prosecution had one significant obstacle: the bloody palm print on the small section of sheetrock cut from the wall in Debbie Carter's bedroom. Early in 1983, Jerry Peters of the OSBI had examined the print carefully and concluded that it was not from Dennis Fritz or Ron Williamson. Nor did it match Debbie Carter. It was a print left by the killer. But what if Jerry Peters had been wrong? Or perhaps in a hurry, or maybe he had just overlooked something? If the print actually belonged to Debbie Carter, then Fritz and Williamson could not be excluded as suspects. Peterson seized upon the idea of exhuming her body and examining the palm prints again. With luck, her hands were not too badly decomposed, and a new set of prints just might, if examined perhaps from a different angle, reveal information that could greatly assist the prosecution and finally bring the murderers to justice. Peggy Stillwell received a call from Dennis Smith. He asked her to come to the police station, but refused to give a reason. She thought, as always, that perhaps there had been a break in the case. When she arrived, Bill Peterson was sitting behind the desk with a sheet of paper in front of him. He explained that they wanted to exhume Debbie's body, and he needed her signature to approve it. Charlie Carter had already stopped by and signed off. Peggy was horrified. The idea of disturbing her daughter was shocking. She said no, but Peterson was prepared for it. He pressed on, asking Peggy if she wanted the murder solved. Of course, but wasn't there some other way? No. If she wanted to find Debbie's killer and bring him to justice, she had to agree to the exhumation. After a few minutes, Peggy scribbled her signature, hurried away from the police department, and drove to the home of her sister, Glenna Lucas. She told Glenna about the meeting with Bill Peterson and the plans to dig up the body. She was actually excited by now, anxious to see her daughter again. "I'll get to touch her and hold her again," she kept saying. Glenna did not share her enthusiasm and wasn't convinced such a reunion was healthy. And she had doubts about the people running the investigation. In the 4.5 years since the murder, she had been forced to chat with Bill Peterson several times about the case. Peggy was not stable. She had never accepted the fact that Debbie was dead. Glenna had repeatedly asked Peterson and the police to filter any news from the investigation through herself or another family member. Peggy could not handle sudden developments and needed her family's protection. Glenna immediately called Bill Peterson and demanded to know what he was planning. He explained that the exhumation was necessary if the family wanted Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz brought to trial for the murder. The bloody palm print stood in the way, and if it actually belonged to Debbie, then he and the police could move with urgency against Fritz and Williamson. Glenna was confused. How did Peterson know the outcome of the reprinting if the body had yet to be exhumed? How could he be so sure that the exhumation would incriminate Fritz and Williamson? Peggy was obsessed with seeing her daughter again. At one point, she said to Glenna, "I've forgotten what her voice sounded like." Glenna was promised by Bill Peterson that the exhumation would be done quickly and be completed before anyone knew it. Peggy was at her station at Brockway Glass when a co-worker walked by and asked her what was happening over at Rosedale Cemetery near Debbie's gravesite. She left the factory, raced across town, but found only an empty grave. Her daughter had been removed. The first set of palm prints had been taken by OSBI agent Jerry Peters on December 9, 1982, during the autopsy. At that time, the hands had been perfect, and Peters had no doubt that he had taken a full and thorough set of prints. When he issued his report 3 months later, he'd been certain in his findings that the bloody print from the sheetrock was not left by Fritz, Williamson, or the victim. Now, though, 4.5 years later, with the murder unsolved and the authorities looking for a break, he suddenly had doubts about his earlier work. 3 days after the exhumation, he issued a revised report in which he concluded that the bloody print matched Debbie Carter's palm. For the first and only time in his 24-year career, Jerry Peters changed his mind. The report was exactly what Bill Peterson needed. Armed with the proof that the bloody print did not belong to some unknown killer, but had been left by Debbie as she struggled for her life, he was free to go after his prime suspects. And it was important to alert the townsfolk, the potential jurors. While the authorities claimed that the exhumation and its details were confidential, Peterson chatted with the Ada Evening News anyway. "What we found confirmed our suspicions. We were checking some evidence," he was quoted as saying. What exactly was found? Peterson wouldn't confirm the details, but a source was willing to tell all. The source said the body was exhumed so the woman's palm prints could be made and compared with a bloody palm print found on her apartment wall. The source went on, "Elimination of the possibility that the bloody palm print was someone other than the victim was crucial to the investigation." "I do feel better about the case," Peterson said. He obtained warrants for the arrests of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz. On Friday morning, May 8th, Rick Carson saw Ron pushing the lawnmower with three wheels along a street on the west side of town. The two talked for a moment. Ron, with long hair, no shirt, ragged jeans, and sneakers, looked as rough as always. He wanted to get a job with the city, and Rick promised to stop by and pick up an application. Ron said he would wait at home that night. Carson then informed his lieutenant that he knew their suspect would in fact be hanging around his apartment on West 12th later in the evening. The arrest was planned, and Rick asked to be involved. If Ron turned violent, Rick wanted to make sure no one got hurt. Instead, four other policemen were sent, including Detective Mike Baskin. Ron was taken into custody without incident. He was wearing the same jeans and sneakers and was still shirtless. At the jail, Mike Baskin read him his Miranda rights and asked if he would like to talk. Sure, why not? Detective James Fox joined the interview. Ron repeatedly said he had never met Debbie Carter, had never been in her apartment, and to the best of his knowledge had never seen her. He never wavered, in spite of some yelling and bullying from the cops, who said over and over that they knew Ron was guilty. Ron was placed in the county jail. At least a month had passed since he had taken any medications. Dennis Fritz was living with his mother and an aunt in Kansas City, keeping busy by painting houses. He'd left Ada a few months earlier. His friendship with Ron Williamson was a distant memory. He hadn't talked to a detective in 4 years and had almost forgotten about the Carter murder. Late on the evening of May 8th, he was watching television by himself. He had worked all day and was still wearing his dirty painter's whites. The night was warm. The windows were open. The phone rang, and an unidentified female voice asked, "Is Dennis Fritz there?" "I'm Dennis Fritz," he answered, and she hung up. Perhaps it was a wrong number, or perhaps his ex-wife was up to something. He settled back in front of the television. His mother and aunt were already asleep in the rear of the house. It was almost 11:30. 15 minutes later, he heard a series of car doors slam nearby. He got up, barefoot, and was walking to the front door when he saw a small army of combat-ready troops, dressed in black and heavily armed, moving across the lawn. "What the hell?" he thought. For a split second, he considered calling the police. The doorbell rang, and when he opened the door, two plainclothes cops grabbed him, pulled him outside, and demanded to know, "Are you Dennis Fritz?" "Yes, I am." "Then you're under arrest for first-degree murder," one growled while the other slapped on the handcuffs. "What murder are you talking about?" Dennis asked, then had a quick thought. How many Dennis Fritzes are there in Kansas City? Surely they've got the wrong one. His aunt appeared at the door, saw the SWAT team advancing on Dennis, submachine guns aimed and ready, and became hysterical. His mother ran from her bedroom as the police entered the house to secure it, though when questioned they were unclear as to whom and what they wished to secure. Dennis did not own a firearm. There were no other known or suspected murderers on the premises, but the SWAT boys had their procedures. Just as Dennis was convinced he was about to be gunned down at the front door, he glanced up and saw a white Stetson hat moving his way. Two nightmares from his past were approaching on the driveway. Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers happily joined the fracas, with shit-eating grins from ear to ear. "Oh, that murder," Dennis thought. In their finest hour, the two small-town cowboys had conned the Kansas City Fugitive Apprehension Unit into conducting the dramatic but senseless raid. "Can I get my shoes?" Dennis asked, and the cops reluctantly agreed. Fritz was placed in the back seat of a police car, where he was joined by an ecstatic Dennis Smith. One of the KC detectives did the driving. As they left, Fritz looked at the heavily armed SWAT boys and thought, how stupid. Any part-time deputy could have made the arrest at the local grocery store. As stunned as he was by the arrest, he had to chuckle as he noticed how dejected the KC police looked. His last image was of his mother, standing in the front door, with her hands over her mouth. They took him to a small interrogation room at a police station in Kansas City. Smith and Rogers went through the Miranda warnings, then announced that they intended to get a confession. Dennis kept thinking of Ward and Fontenot and was determined to give them nothing. Smith became the nice guy, his pal, who really wanted to help. Rogers was instantly abusive, cursing, threatening, poking Dennis in the chest repeatedly. 4 years had passed since their last session. In June 1983, after Fritz had severely flunked the second polygraph, Smith, Rogers, and Featherstone had kept him in the basement of the Ada Police Department for 3 hours and badgered him. They got nothing then, and they were getting nothing now. Rogers was furious. The cops had known for years that Fritz and Williamson raped and murdered Debbie Carter, and now the crime had been solved. All they needed was a confession. "I have nothing to confess," Fritz said over and over. "What evidence do you have? Show me the evidence." One of Roger's favorite lines was, "You're insulting my intelligence." And each time Fritz was tempted to say, "What intelligence?" But he did not want to get slapped. After 2 hours of abuse, Fritz finally said, "All right, I'll confess." The cops were relieved. Since they had no proof, they were about to crack the case with a confession. Smith hustled out to find a tape recorder. Rogers quickly arranged his notepad and pens. "Let's have it." When they were all set, Fritz looked directly at the tape recorder and said, "Here's the truth. I did not kill Debbie Carter and know nothing about her murder." Smith and Rogers went ballistic. More threats, more verbal abuse. Fritz was rattled and frightened, but he held firm. He maintained his innocence, and they finally called off the interrogation. He refused extradition to Oklahoma and waited in jail for the process to run its course. Later that day, Saturday, Ron was led from the jail to the police station for another interview. Smith and Rogers, back from their thrilling arrest of Fritz, were waiting. Their goal was to make him talk. The interrogation had been planned since the day before the arrest. The Dreams of Ada had just been published, and there was criticism of the methods of Smith and Rogers. They decided that Smith, who lived in Ada, should be replaced by Rusty Featherstone, who lived in Oklahoma City. They also decided not to use video. Dennis Smith was in the building but stayed away from the interview room. After leading the investigation for over 4 years and believing for much of that time that Williamson was guilty, he nonetheless avoided the crucial interrogation. The Ada Police Department was well stocked with audio and video equipment, and it was frequently used. Interrogations, and especially confessions, were almost always recorded on tape. The police were quite aware of the powerful impact of showing a confession to a jury. Ask Ward and Fontenot. Ron's second polygraph 4 years earlier had been taped by Featherstone at the Ada Police Department. When confessions were not recorded on video, they were often taken by audio. The police had plenty of tape recorders. And when neither audio nor video was used, the suspect was usually asked to write, if he could in fact read and write, his own version of what happened. If the suspect happened to be illiterate, then a detective would write the statement, read it back to the defendant, and ask him to sign it. None of these methods were used on May 9th. Williamson, who was quite literate and had a much wider vocabulary than either of his two interrogators, watched as Featherstone took notes. He said he understood his Miranda rights and agreed to talk. The police version reads as follows. Williamson said, "Okay, December the 8th, 1982, I was hanging out at the Coach Light frequently, and I was there one night looking at a girl, a pretty girl, and thought I should follow her home." Williamson paused, then acted as if he wished to say something that started with the letter F, but then paused again. Then he continued, "Thought, what if something bad would happen that night?" and followed her home. Williamson then paused and talked about when he stole a stereo. Williamson then said, "I was with Dennis, and we went to the Holiday Inn and told a girl that we had a bar in our car and got her, and she jumped." Williamson talked in sporadic phrases, and Agent Rogers asked Williamson to concentrate and get back to talking about the Debbie Carter case. Williamson said, "Okay, I had a dream about killing Debbie, was on her, had a cord around her neck, stabbed her frequently, pulled the rope tight around her neck." Williamson said, "I'm worried about what this will do to my family, and then he said, "My mother is dead now." Agent Rogers asked Williamson if he and Dennis were there that night, and Williamson answered, "Yes." Agent Featherstone asked Williamson, "Did you go there with the intention to kill her?" Williamson responded, "Probably." Agent Featherstone asked, "Why?" Williamson responded, "She made me mad." Agent Featherstone asked, "How do you mean? Mean to you? A bitch?" Williamson responded, "No." Williamson paused briefly, then said, "Oh, my God, you can't expect me to confess. I've got my family. I've got my nephew to protect. My sister, it will tear her up. It can't hurt my mother now since she is dead. It's been on my mind since it happened." At about 1938 hours, Williamson said, "If you're going to try me on this, I want Tanner in Tulsa. No, I want David Morris." The mention of a lawyer spooked the detectives, and they stopped the confession. They called David Morris, who instructed them to stop interrogating Ron immediately. The statement was not signed by Ron. It was never shown to him. Armed with another dream confession, the case was coming together nicely for the cops and prosecutors. They had learned with Ward and Fontenot that a lack of physical evidence should not get in the way of an urgent prosecution. The fact that Debbie Carter was not stabbed was of little consequence. Juries will convict if they can be adequately shocked. If one dream confession could nail Williamson, then another could put him away. A few days later, a jailer named John Christian stopped by Ron's cell. He and Ron had grown up in the same neighborhood. The Christian household was full of boys, one the same age as Ron, and he was often included in lunch and dinner. They played baseball together in the streets and the leagues and attended Bing Junior High. Untreated and unmedicated, Ron was far from a model inmate. The Pontotoc County Jail is a windowless concrete bunker, for some reason built on the west side of the courthouse lawn. The ceilings are low, the atmosphere cramped and claustrophobic, and when someone screams, everyone hears it. Ron screamed often. When he wasn't yelling, he was singing, crying, wailing, complaining, or either protesting his innocence or ranting on about Debbie Carter. He was placed in one of the two solitary cells, as far away from the crowded bullpen as possible, but the jail was so small that Ron could disrupt it from anywhere. Only John Christian could settle him down, and the other inmates came to appreciate the changing of the guard. When Christian arrived, he immediately went to Ron's cell and calmed him. They would talk about the old days, growing up, playing ball, friends they had known back then. They talked about the Carter case and how unfair it was for Ron to be charged. For 8 hours, Ron was quiet. His solitary cell was a rat hole, but he managed to sleep and read. Before Christian punched out, he checked on Ron, who was usually pacing, smoking, getting himself psyched up to begin the racket as soon as the new guard arrived. Late in the evening of May 22nd, Ron was awake and knew Christian was at the front desk. Ron called him back and wanted to talk about the murder. He had a copy of The Dreams of Ada and said he might have a dream confession of his own. According to Christian, Ron said, "Now, just imagine this. I dreamed this is what took place. Just imagine that I was living in Tulsa, and I'd been drinking and taking Quaaludes all day, and I drove to Buzzy's club, coach-like club. And just imagine that I drank some more and got a bit drunker. Just suppose that I ended up at Debbie Carter's door and knocked on the door, and she said, 'Just a minute, I'm on the phone.' Just imagine I busted the door in and I raped and killed her." Williamson then said, "Don't you think, if I was the person that killed her, that I would have gotten some money from my friends and left town?" Christian thought little of the conversation, but did repeat it to a fellow officer. It was repeated again and again, and finally made it to Gary Rogers. The detective saw an opportunity for additional evidence against their killer. 2 months later, he asked Christian to repeat what Ron had told him. Rogers typed up a report, added quotation marks where he thought appropriate, and the police and prosecutor then had their second dream confession. Not a single word was included to reflect Ron's many denials of involvement in the crime. As usual, the facts were not important. Ron was not living in Tulsa at the time of the murder. He possessed neither a vehicle nor a driver's license. Chapter 7. For Annette Hudson and Renee Simmons, the news that their brother had been arrested and charged with murder was overwhelming. Since his release from prison the previous October, they had been deeply concerned about his deteriorating mental health and his physical well-being, but they had no idea murder charges were looming. The rumors had been around for years, but so much time had passed, the family had assumed the police were busy with other suspects and other cases. When Juanita died 2 years earlier, she was confident she had given Dennis Smith clear evidence that Ron was not involved. Annette and Renee believed this, too. Both were living frugally, raising their families, working occasionally, paying the bills, and saving money when possible. They did not have the cash to hire a criminal defense lawyer. Annette talked to David Morris, but he had no interest in the case. John Tanner was in Tulsa, too far away and too expensive. Though Ron had dragged them through the court system many times, they were still unprepared for his sudden arrest and the allegations of murder. Friends backed away. The stares and whispers began. An acquaintance said to Annette, "It's not your fault. You can't help what your brother did." "My brother is not guilty," Annette shot back. She and Renee repeated this continually, but few people wanted to hear it. Forget the presumption of innocence. The cops had their man. Why would they have arrested Ron if he wasn't guilty? Annette's son, Michael, then a 15-year-old sophomore, suffered through a class discussion on current local events, the principal one being the arrest of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz for the murder. Since his last name was Hudson, none of his classmates knew that Michael's uncle was the accused killer. Sentiments in the class ran strongly against the two men. Annette was at the school the following morning and got the matter resolved. The teacher apologized profusely and promised to redirect class discussions. Renee and Gary Simmons were living in Chickasha, about 90 miles away, and the distance gave them some relief. Annette, though, had never left Ada, and though she now desperately wanted to flee, she had to stay and support her little brother. The Sunday, May 10th edition of the Ada Evening News ran a front-page story about the arrests with a photo of Debbie Carter. Bill Peterson provided most of the details. He confirmed that the body had been exhumed and that the mysterious print, in fact, belonged to the victim. He claimed that both Fritz and Williamson had been suspects for more than a year, but did not explain why. As to the investigation itself, he said, "We came to the end of our rope in this investigation about 6 months ago and began to decide how to approach these things." Of special interest was the news that the FBI had been involved in the case. 2 years earlier, the Ada police requested its assistance. The FBI studied the evidence and provided the police with a psychological profile of the killers, though Peterson did not share this with the newspaper. The following day, there was another front-page story, this time with mugshots of Ron and Dennis. Even by mugshot standards, their photos were menacing enough to get convictions. The story repeated the details from the day before, specifically that both men had been arrested and charged with first-degree rape, rape by instrumentation, and first-degree murder. Oddly enough, officials refused to comment on whether the two men had made statements about the crime. Evidently, the reporters in Ada had become so accustomed to confessions that they assumed such statements were generic to all criminal investigations. Though they withheld news about their first dream confession from Ron, the authorities did release the affidavit used for the arrest warrants. The story quoted the affidavit as saying that both pubic and scalp hair were recovered from Miss Carter's body and bedding that were consistent microscopically with that of Ronald Keith Williamson and Dennis Fritz. And both men had long criminal records. Ron's tally was 15 misdemeanors, drunk driving and such, plus one felony for the forgery that sent him to prison. Fritz had two DUIs, some driving charges, plus the old marijuana conviction. Bill Peterson confirmed again that the body had been exhumed to re-examine a palm print, which was found to be the victim's. He added that the two men had been suspects in the case for more than a year. The story concluded by reminding everyone that Carter died from asphyxiation when a washcloth was stuffed down her throat during the rape. That same Monday, Ron was led from the jail across the lawn to the courthouse, about 50 steps, and made his first appearance before Judge John David Miller, the magistrate who handled preliminary matters. He said he did not have a lawyer and wasn't sure if he could afford one. He was taken back to jail. A few hours later, an inmate by the name of Mickey Wayne Harrell allegedly overheard Ron crying, saying, "I'm sorry, Debbie." This was immediately reported to the jailer. Ron then allegedly asked Harrell if he would draw a tattoo on his arm, one that said, "Ron loves Debbie." With a hot new crime on the docket, the gossip festered in the jail. The snitching games, always a part of jail life because the police were so willing to play along, began in earnest. The quickest way to freedom, or at least to a reduced sentence, was to hear or claim to hear a prized suspect confess in whole or in part to his crime and then trade this off in an attractive plea bargain with the prosecutor. In most jails, snitching was rare because the informants feared retribution from other inmates. In Ada, snitching was widely practiced because it worked so well. 2 days later, Ron was taken back to court to discuss the matter of his legal representation. He appeared before Judge John David Miller, and things did not go well. Still unmedicated, he was loud and belligerent and began by yelling, "I didn't do this killing. I'm getting damn tired of being on this rap now. I feel sorry for the family, but..." Judge Miller tried to stop him, but Ron wanted to talk. "I didn't kill her. I don't know who killed her. My mother was alive at the time, and she knew where I was." Judge Miller attempted to explain to Ron that the hearing was not designed to allow defendants to plead their case, but Ron kept on. "I want these charges dropped," he said over and over. "This is ridiculous." Judge Miller asked him if he understood the charges against him, to which Ron replied, "I'm innocent. Never been in her company. Never been in a car with her." As his rights were being read into the record, Ron continued ranting. "I've been in jail 3 times, and each time they have tried to say I had something to do with this murder." When the name of Dennis Fritz was read aloud, Ron interrupted. "This guy didn't have anything to do with it. I knew him at the time. He didn't go to the coach light." The judge finally entered a plea of not guilty. Ron was led away, cursing bitterly as he went. Annette watched and wept quietly. She went to the jail every day, sometimes twice if the jailers allowed. She knew most of them, and they all knew Ronnie, and the rules were often bent slightly to allow more visitation. He was disturbed, still unmedicated, and in need of professional help. He was irate and bitter for being arrested for a crime he had nothing to do with. He was also humiliated. For 4.5 years, he had lived with the suspicion that he had committed an unspeakable murder. The suspicion was bad enough. Ada was his hometown, his people, his current and former friends, the folks who watched him grow up in church, the fans who remembered him as a great athlete. The whispers and stares were painful, but he had endured them for years. He was innocent, and the truth, if the cops could ever find it, would clear his name. But to be suddenly arrested and thrown in jail and have his mug shot on the front page was devastating. He wasn't sure if he had ever met Debbie Carter. While Dennis Fritz sat in a jail cell in Kansas City and waited for the extradition process to send him back to Ada, he was struck by the irony of his arrest. Murder? For years he had dealt with the aftermath of his wife's, and many times he'd almost felt like a victim himself. Murder. He had never physically harmed anyone. He was small, slightly built, averse to fighting and violence. Sure, he'd been in plenty of bars and some rough places, but he'd always managed to slip away when the brawling began. If Ron Williamson didn't start the fight, then he would certainly stay and finish it, but not Dennis. He was a suspect only because of his friendship with Ron. Fritz wrote a long letter to the Ada Evening News to explain why he was fighting extradition. He said he refused to return with Smith and Rogers because he couldn't believe he had been charged with the murder. He was innocent, had nothing to do with the crime, and needed some time to get his thoughts together. He was trying to find a good defense lawyer, and his family was scrambling for money. He summarized his involvement in the investigation. Because he had nothing to hide and wanted to cooperate, he did everything the police asked, gave samples of saliva, fingerprints, handwriting, and hair, even one from his mustache, took two polygraph exams, which, according to Dennis Smith, he severely flunked. Fritz said that he found out later that he had not flunked the polygraph tests. About the investigation, Fritz wrote, "For 3.5 years, they have had access to my fingerprints, handwriting, and hair samples to match up with the evidence found at the scene of the crime and any other evidence, if any, to have me arrested long ago. But, according to your paper, 6 months ago they were at the end of their rope and had to decide how to handle these things. I'm not that dumb to know it doesn't take no crime lab 3.5 years to match up my volunteered evidence." Dennis, the former science teacher, had studied hair evidence years earlier after he had submitted samples. His letter included this paragraph. "How can I be charged with rape and murder on just flimsy evidence such as hair, which can only distinguish ethnic groups of people and not individual characteristics within the same group of people in the same ethnic group? Any expert witness in their field knows there could be over 500,000 people that have the same consistencies of hair." He concluded with a desperate claim of innocence and asked the question, "Am I guilty until proven innocent, or innocent until proven guilty?" Pontotoc County did not have a full-time public defender. Those accused of crimes who could not afford a lawyer were required to sign a pauper's oath. Then the judge would appoint a local lawyer as indigent counsel. Since few people of means get themselves charged with felonies, most of the serious crimes involved indigent defendants. Robberies, drugs, and assaults were the crimes of the lower classes, and since most of the defendants were guilty, their court-appointed lawyers could investigate, interview, plea bargain, do the paperwork, close the file, and pick up a very modest fee. In fact, the fees were so modest, most lawyers preferred to avoid the cases. The haphazard indigent defense system was fraught with problems. Judges often assigned cases to lawyers with little or no criminal law experience. There was no money for expert witnesses and other expenses. Nothing makes a small-town bar scatter more quickly than a capital murder case. The visibility ensures that the lawyer will be watched carefully as he fights to protect the rights of a low-class defendant accused of some heinous crime. The hours required are burdensome and can virtually shut down a small law office. The fee is nothing compared to the work, and the appeals drag on forever. The great fear is that no one will agree to represent the accused and that the judge will simply assign the case. Most courtrooms are usually teeming with lawyers when court is in session, but they become empty tombs when a capital murder defendant is hauled in with his pauper's oath. The lawyers flee to their offices, lock the doors, and unplug the phones. Perhaps the most colorful courthouse regular in Ada was Barney Ward, a blind lawyer known for his snappy dressing, hard living, tall stories, and penchant for being involved in most of the legal gossip in Ada. He seemed to know everything that went on in the courthouse. Barney lost his eyesight as a teenager when a high school chemistry experiment went awry. He treated the tragedy as a temporary setback and finished high school. He enrolled at East Central in Ada, where his mother served as his reader. After graduation, he went to Norman and studied law at the University of Oklahoma, again with his mother at his side. He graduated, passed the bar exam, returned to Ada, and ran for county attorney. He won, and for several years served as the county's chief prosecutor. In the mid-1950s, he established a private practice specializing in criminal defense, and soon had the reputation as a strong advocate for his clients. Quick on his feet, Barney could sniff a weakness in the prosecution's case and would pounce on opposing witnesses. He was a brutal cross-examiner and loved a good scrap. In one legendary encounter, Barney actually threw a punch at another lawyer. He and David Morris were in court arguing evidentiary matters. Both were frustrated, things were tense, and Morris made the mistake of saying, "Look, Judge, even a blind man can see this." Barney lunged at him, or, in his general direction, threw a roundhouse right and barely missed. Order was restored. Morris apologized, but kept his distance. Everybody knew Barney, and he was often seen around the courthouse with his faithful assistant, Linda, who read everything for him and took his notes. From time to time, he used a seeing-eye dog to help him around, though he preferred a young lady. He was friendly with everyone and never forgot a voice. The other lawyers elected him president of the Bar Association, and not out of sympathy. Barney was so well-liked that he was asked to join a poker club. He produced a set of Braille cards, claimed that only he could deal, and was soon raking in all the chips. The other players decided that perhaps it was best if Barney played but never dealt. His winnings were somewhat reduced. Each year, the other lawyers invited Barney to Deer Camp, a week-long boys-only getaway with lots of bourbon and poker and dirty jokes and thick stews and, time permitting, some hunting. Barney's dream was to kill a deer. In the woods, his friends found a nice buck and quietly maneuvered Barney into position, handed him the rifle, adjusted it carefully, aimed it, then whispered, "Fire!" Barney pulled the trigger, and though he missed badly, his friends claimed the deer had narrowly escaped death. Barney told the story for decades. Like many hard drinkers, he finally had to quit. At the time, he was using a dog for guidance, and the dog had to be replaced when he couldn't break the habit of leading Barney to the liquor store. Evidently, he went there often, because one lingering bit of lore is that the whiskey store went out of business when Barney went off the booze. He loved to make money and had little patience with clients who couldn't pay. His motto was, "Innocent until proven broke." By the mid-1980s, though, Barney was a bit past his prime. He was known to occasionally miss things in trial because he was asleep. He wore thick, dark glasses that covered much of his face, and the judges and lawyers couldn't tell if he was listening or napping. His opponents caught on, and the strategy, whispered because Barney heard everything, was to drag a case or a hearing past lunch and into the afternoon when he always took his nap. If you could make it to 3 p.m., your chances of beating Barney rose dramatically. 2 years earlier, he had been approached by the family of Tommy Ward, no relation, but had passed on the case. He was convinced Ward and Fontenot were innocent, but he preferred not to handle capital cases. The paperwork was overwhelming and not one of his strengths. Now he was approached again. Judge John David Miller asked Barney to represent Ron Williamson. Barney was the most experienced criminal defense attorney in the county, and his expertise was needed. After a brief hesitation, he said yes. A pure lawyer, he knew the Constitution inside and out, and he believed strongly that every defendant, regardless of how unpopular, was entitled to a vigorous defense. On June 1, 1987, Barney Ward was appointed by the court to represent Ron, his first death penalty client. Annette and Renee were pleased. They knew him, and they knew of his reputation as one of the best criminal defense lawyers in town. The lawyer and the client got off to a rocky start. Ron was tired of the jail, and the jail was quite tired of him. Conferences took place in a small visitor's room near the front door, a place Barney found too cozy with his unruly client. He made a call and arranged a mental checkup for Ron. A new supply of Thorazine was prescribed, and much to the relief of Barney and the entire jail, the drug worked beautifully. In fact, it worked so well the guards overused it to keep peace. Ron was sleeping like an infant again. During one conference, though, he could barely speak. Barney met with the jailers, the dosage was readjusted, and Ron sprang back to life. He was generally uncooperative with his lawyer. He offered little but a steady stream of rambling denials. He was being railroaded into a conviction, just like Ward and Fontenot. Barney was frustrated from the day he was appointed, but he plowed ahead. Glenn Gore was in jail on kidnapping and assault charges. His court-appointed counsel was Greg Saunders, a young lawyer who was building a civil practice in Ada. During a client conference at the jail, he and Gore almost came to blows. Saunders walked next door to the courthouse and asked Judge Miller to remove him from the case. Judge Miller refused, so Saunders said he would take the next capital murder appointment if he could get rid of Gore. "A deal," said Judge Miller. "You're now representing Dennis Fritz in the Carter murder." Though Greg Saunders was apprehensive about his death penalty case, he was also excited about working closely with Barney Ward. As an undergraduate at East Central, he had dreamed of being a trial lawyer and had often cut classes when he knew Barney was in action. He had watched Barney rip shaky witnesses and intimidate prosecutors. Barney respected judges but did not fear them, and he could chat with a jury. He never used his disability as a crutch, but at crucial moments he could use it to arouse sympathy. To Greg Saunders, Barney was a brilliant courtroom lawyer. Working independently, but also quietly working together, they filed a truckload of motions and soon had the district attorney's office scrambling. On June 11th, Judge Miller called a hearing on issues raised by both the state and the defense. Barney was demanding a list of the names of all the witnesses the prosecution expected to use in the case. Oklahoma law required such disclosure, but Bill Peterson was having trouble with the statute. Barney explained it to him. The prosecutor wanted to disclose only those witnesses he planned to use at the preliminary hearing. "Not so," said Judge Miller, and Peterson was ordered to timely notify the defense of any new witness. Barney was in a feisty mood and prevailed on most of the motions. He was also showing signs of frustration. In one aside, he commented on being court-appointed and not wanting to spend too much time on the case. He vowed to do a proper job, but was worried about getting consumed with his first capital murder trial. The following day, he filed a motion requesting additional counsel for Ron. The state did not object, and on June 16th, Frank Baber was appointed by Judge Miller to help Barney. The legal wrangling and paperwork battles continued as both sides prepared for the preliminary hearing. Dennis Fritz was placed in a cell not far from Ron Williamson. He couldn't see Ron, but he could certainly hear him. When he wasn't over-medicated, Ron yelled constantly. For hours he would stand at the bars in his cell door and bellow over and over, "I am innocent! I am innocent!" His deep and husky voice echoed through the cramped building. He was a wounded animal in a cage, in dire need of help. The prisoners were stressed anyway, but Ron's screeching voice added another thick layer of anxiety. Other inmates would yell back at him and taunt him about killing Debbie Carter. The bickering and cursing back and forth were occasionally amusing, but generally nerve-wracking. The jailers moved Ron from his isolation cell into a bullpen with a dozen others, an arrangement that proved disastrous. The men had little privacy and practically lived shoulder to shoulder. Ron respected no one's space. A petition quickly appeared. It was signed by the other prisoners and begged the jailers to take Ron back to isolation. To prevent a riot or a killing, the guards agreed. Then there were long periods of silence, and everyone, inmates and guards, would breathe easier. Soon the entire jail knew that either John Christian was on duty, or the guards had given Ron another toxic dose of Thorazine. The Thorazine quieted him, though at times there were other side effects. It often made his legs itch, and the Thorazine shuffle became part of the jail's routine as Ron stood at the bars of his cell and ducked and weaved from side to side for hours. Fritz would talk to him and try to calm him, but it was hopeless. Ron's cries of innocence were painful to hear, especially for Dennis, who knew him best. It was obvious that Ron needed much more than a bottle of pills. Neuroleptic drugs are synonymous with tranquilizers and antipsychotics, and are used primarily on schizophrenics. Thorazine is a neuroleptic, and it has a tortured history. In the 1950s, it began flooding state mental hospitals. It's a potent drug that strongly